Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Meta, a podcast about podcasts. My name is Peter Wells, and I'm joined today by a man I've been listening to for, I feel like, two decades. I might be getting the timing wrong there. When I first moved down to Melbourne back in the early 2000s, one of the first things I fell in love with was Triple R. Look, you know, we did have decent community radio stations up in Sydney, but nothing matched Triple R in terms of what I feel was also kind of the golden age of Triple R, those early 2000s when I first moved here. Anyway, one of the highlights of the calendar at the time was a show called The Sweetest Plum, and I really, really dug it.
Reverse, you might want to redo it. The show is called The Pinch.
Oh, sorry, yes, it was called The Pinch. Holy crap, yeah. That's how long...
I'll let you go back and redo it.
No, keep it all in. Oh my God, yeah, you're right. Declan Fay, welcome to the show, mate.
Thank you very much for having me. Yes, that show on Triple R was called The Pinch. I assume were you listening to it in the late night version,
or had we
already evolved? Yeah.
So I had like four shows that were must listens at the time, and it was The Pinch, it was The Spin Doctors.
Oh yeah.
There were a couple of others. I'm trying to think. Yeah, Run Like You Stole Something.
Oh yeah.
It was just it was such a what felt like such an incredible creative time at that station. What was it like being at the station at the time?
So that was, when did I start? I started with Chris Kennett actually in a version before The Pinch, which was, we used to call it a cult show, but I think that was just because it was very late at night and had some very stoned people listening to it. But that was a show called Unexplained Phenomena that Chris had been doing actually, I think, since high school or just out of high school, that was kind of like... It was a very early kind of show that was kind of about like weird internet memes, like conspiracy theories, like everything from like supernatural, extraterrestrial stuff. And he asked me to go on that show when a co-host of his dropped out because we knew each other at uni. And I didn't know a lot about that stuff. And I would just, every week, I was just hanging in there. I think that he wanted a phone answerer because he didn't like talking to the people that used to call in the middle of the night. So I didn't mind doing it though. Like I kind of like, again, a kid from the suburbs, from a pretty conservative Catholic family. And then suddenly you're talking to people that are kind of having seances in their house. Ooh. And everything from that to a woman would call in whose cat she believed could talk.
Mm-hmm.
And she would put the cat on the phone and you could hear the cat purring like, and then you would hear this like, it kind of could say hello. Like you could hear this like, how, wow. I swear to God. And so there was that, or there was just people that would just call up. Like it was like, we'd get weird suburban kids that were a bit like us. And so that was Unexplained Phenomena. And then round about early 2000, I want to say 2002, it just started to morph a little bit more to, we would talk comedy news, you know, I mean, the extent of it at the time was we would Google like the weirdest stories of the week and talk about those and then sort of thumb through the Herald Sun. And that was when it became The Pinch, and then it sort of moved to the main comedy show on Triple R. We started doing comedy festival shows, and Chris and I have often said we were kind of in some ways doing a podcast before there was podcasts, in that the station manager at the time, Tracy Hutchison, the first feedback we ever got from her, she said, I listened to your show for the first time last night. I like the dynamic between you and I like the energy, but I'm not sure that your first talk break should have been half an hour long, and which is a long time for radio talk break. Like if you're on commercial radio, maybe 4 minutes, and Triple R, you know, probably you're getting up to 7-9 minutes, but 7 to 9 minutes. But yeah, that was kind of where that sort of, you know, I liked that it was it was a show for kind of outsiders and people that weren't listening to commercial media. I kind of always liked being like a little bit, you know, the showbiz term they use is off Broadway. I kind of liked being off Broadway. And that's what, you know, when you say you hadn't, you know, you didn't, hadn't heard radio like that, that's kind of great because that's what we wanted. We didn't want it to sound like a commercial radio show.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that I was pretty gung-ho about podcasts way back in the day. Like I remember when iTunes 4.9 came out, and that was the first one that had the podcast directory built into it. And, you know, by then I was still living in Melbourne at the time. But yeah, yeah, like I quickly transitioned all of those shows that I mentioned earlier, Run Like You Stole Something and The Pinch and also The Spin Doctors. I moved all of that stuff across to the iPod, Mini at the time. And yeah, that suddenly became it. Like it suddenly blew my mind that, oh my God, I've got like, you know, DVR, but for radio, this is fantastic.
And we did it. We Chris was very keen on podcasting early on. He was doing like early. We got one of the listeners, a guy called Seb Conn, made a website for us in early 2000s and would have like little tracks that could stream. And not many people were doing that. I didn't even really understand what it was. One week he just put up a story about a VW catching on fire and people could re-listen to it. And I kind of went, I really like this, that like that story is not just a moment in time that you had to have been listening to. Like anybody could listen to it at any time. And so then we, yeah, when it moved to the 7 o'clock version, we'd pretty much podcast the whole show, but you had to take the music out. It would just be like, it basically became just the dialogue. And I didn't overly get it yet. I was kind of a late adopter of iTunes and I didn't overly get what it was going to be. But it's funny, as we started to do live shows for The Pinch, people would say, I can't listen to you at 7, but I've been listening to your podcast. Or we would do, you know, you'd get an email from a kind of interstate listener or even international listeners we were starting to get at the time who'd say, I've been listening to your podcast. And I remember on the Libsyn, who is a podcast server, used to have its own, this is pre-iTunes, we'd have its own chart of the top shows. And I remember we would sort of come up near the top, but the show you could never beat was a show that was called, and we always thought it was funny that we couldn't beat the show. It was called Keith and His Girlfriend Talk Shit. And if you're a deep podcast nerd, you'll know that that's the show that then evolved into one of the first biggest podcasts called Keith and the Girl, because they were boyfriend and girlfriend. Then they split and it just became him and his girlfriend talking about sort of the aftermath of their relationship and trying to be friends. And that was a very, very early popular podcast. So that was what planted all the seeds for me to then, after I finished at Triple R, to go on and start The Sweetest Plum.
Yeah, I remember that early time of podcasting where there'd be weird shows like The Dawn and Drew Show that was inexplicably number one around the world just because it was something new and it was, yeah, again, I think that was like two hipsters with lots of tattoos, but they lived in like rural America. And so it was a really bizarre fish out of water kind of thing. But yeah, I loved that at the time.
It was sort of like, it was a bit like, it didn't know, like commercial stations and commercial entities hadn't picked up on it as a thing yet. Radio stations didn't really understand it because they want you tuning in so they can sell advertising at that time. And so people didn't really get what it was. I mean, even as we moved, the inspiration for The Sweetest Plum was a couple of things. One was Chris and I, who I worked with at Triple R, wrote at Rove for years, and then that show finished and we then moved on to a series of very failed TV pilots at Channel 7, which is they were trying to do comedy and we kept going on to different shows, and you always know when a pilot is or when a show is about to be axed because they literally first they start removing furniture out of the room. Like literally while you're writing on a table, some guy you've never met will walk in and remove the table. And then gradually they start removing staff. Like you walk in and the woman who was doing the research for the show has just been disappeared. And I remember I was writing with Nick Maxwell on that show, who people might remember was the voice of Kevin Rudd on Rove, the kind of maniacal laugh of Kevin Rudd. That was Nick. Nick does all the video insert stuff on the weekly at the moment. So the stuff that all the little interstitial video bits, that's Nick. And he has a very perverse kind of very distinct sense of humor that only he can sort of write. And him and I were, there was a bunch of us working on this show, but him and I had made friends on this pilot that was kind of bursting into flames and it was about to combust. And one day we went for lunch and I knew the show was ending, and we were in South Melbourne, and we went, it was kind of a sign of how everything was going. We went to possibly the worst place you could go to lunch. It was a, you know, when you get a Hungry Jack's, but it's stuck on the side of a service station.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know, there's like mm-hmm. one miserable 17-year-old girl working in there. And
that's my local like Thomastown, mate.
Yeah. That's right. And so I remember eating there, and it kind of, we didn't want to go back to the office because we were like, I think we're going to be fired. And Nick had been listening to the Russell Brand podcast that was being done at the time, that I think it was just before he then got fired for making quite salacious comments. But that was one of the first times a podcast kind of ended up in the news, because he was such high profile. He'd made some, they were pretty distasteful comments about a friend of his and someone else in the news and something they'd done together. And he got dragged, but because he got sacked and he was so high profile, people were talking a lot about podcasts. And Nick actually said to me, he goes, you know, I listened to that podcast, and he goes, I really liked it, like, not for the controversial thing, but you could hear Russell Brand for an hour, and it wasn't like an interview on a TV show or radio station where it's him for 5 minutes, a lot of gags, you play a sting at the end like Triple M, and then you go off to a
you do that, you well know,
to a Jimmy Bunce. Yeah, to a Jimmy Bunce. Well, I worked at Triple M, so I'm very familiar with how it works. But then you go off to a track or an ad or a whatever. And so Nick was talking about it, and then I said, would you want to do a podcast? Like, we could just, you know, I remember how we used to post it at Triple R, and would you want to do it? And he said, yeah, sure. And so basically we were correct. That show was axed, I think, that day or the next day. And a few days later, we started plugging in. It was those old white Macs mm-hmm. that were very chunky, and they'd crack if you closed them too tight. We started plugging it in. We did what you did when you learn how to do anything these days. You go on YouTube and you look up how to make a podcast, and there's a 14-year-old kid doing everything really fast and really smart. And what you do is you click on this mm-hmm. and you go to this mm-hmm. and then you do that and then you do that. And I was just scribbling it down. The Mac had GarageBand on it, and we started recording. We didn't even have a name. We just we literally, on the first one, about a few minutes before we went to air, we decided to call it The Sweetest Plum for two reasons. One was, we always liked that scene in The Simpsons where it's Krusty's comeback special. And
a single plum.
Krusty said, and that's right. And then Lisa goes, Krusty says to Lisa and Bart, kids, I don't know how to thank you. You've got my career back on track. I don't know what I could do. I'll do anything you want. And then Lisa goes, it's okay, we're getting 50% of the t-shirt sales. And then Krusty goes, what? But that's The Sweetest Plum. And we always like that quote. And then there was this thing when we were riding at Rove, anyone that kind of got the easy job for the day, like if somebody was kind of like, there was one guy that just got to do the what this, who was literally going through boxes of like rotten vegetables that people had sent in that looked like cock and balls. And we would say, ah, oh, that person's got the sweetest plum today. It was kind of like, that's the easiest job. Like, and it became this kind of running joke. And so I just said, should we call it The Sweetest Plum? And so, that's what we called the show. And it was just totally organic. It wasn't like, oh, we need a name that stands out on our grid, or it was just, let's call it that. Like 2 minutes before the show, plugged the mics in and just started recording, had no idea what we were going to talk about. And we just started talking, and you can hear that in the first shows. They're not very well directed, and they float around. And sometimes we put the mics in wrong. Like there's one episode where they're plugged in and the mics are monodirectional, but we've faced them the wrong way. So we're talking like across the table and the voices are really, really soft. There's a couple where like one of the mics will be turned off, but you can hear us kind of finding the shape of it. And I can hear us kind of working out what it is. And I've said this to a few people. I actually struggled with it because I was so used to doing radio stations, and I was so used to doing commercial, like writing for commercial media, that I was used to things being in very short sound bites. And you can hear Nick's like going off on a tangent, and there's this kind of, I'm trying to drag him back to the main story. And because I was used to, oh, you have to get out after 4 minutes, or you have to find, like, you know, what they call in comedy or radio, you've got to find a tag. What's the tag? What's the button on the sketch or the scene? And then I kind of realized maybe like 4 or 5 episodes through, oh, actually what Nick's doing there, like putting a tangent on a tangent on a tangent, that's actually the heart of it, because that's what people don't get to hear. They hear the bit that everyone's planned, but they haven't heard where it might go. Mm-hmm. And I realized, like, oh, just keep going with that. Like, go to those places that you wouldn't hear on a radio show. You know, the bit that comes after the 6-minute interview with all the kind of punchy gags that everyone's planned. And so that was kind of the birth of it. And then ironically, once we started doing that is when it blew up. I think probably a colleague of yours, Michael Lallo from The Age, wrote an article which was the best podcasts in the Australia is making some of the best podcasts in the world, and wrote a list of podcasts. And from my memory, he literally put in pretty much every podcast that was out at the time, because there was only about 12 podcasts in Australia. It was a very thoughtful article. Like, he clearly listened to the episodes, but he literally listed the 12 episodes that were on iTunes. And from there, it just caught this moment in time where it very early 2010, and it just caught this wave. It was Ricky Gervais was doing his podcast with Steve Merchant and Carl Pilkington overseas. It just caught this moment in time. I remember going to see Ira Glass talk at the Athenaeum Theatre. And he said, look, I'm really astounded. We don't even have the show on in Australia. We just have a podcast, and I've sold out the Athenaeum Theatre. Mm-hmm. And it was this moment in time, I think, where all the alternative media hadn't kicked in yet. Like, you still had your 4 TV channels. You had cable TV, but a very minimal amount of people watching, you know, especially comedy on that. Streaming hadn't kicked in. The commercial stations weren't streaming their shows yet for radio. And so you had this moment where everyone was trying to find something that wasn't the mainstream. Mm-hmm. Like, it was just this moment before that had been kind of commercialized, and people were reaching for it. And so you got people looking for stuff that they couldn't normally find. And so we were very, very, very lucky to land in that moment.
I've got so many questions to follow up with, but we'll start with you mentioned the kind of long running jokes like the Sweetest Plum that just kind of came out of nowhere and have now become part of the show. Do you worry sometimes that that might alienate people who, you know, weren't listening 10 years ago? And, you know, when you make these
So you're right. I've thought about that a lot. Like, a lot of it was accidental things early on. Like, when you do commercial radio, they often get you to plan what your spikes will be. Like, what's the thing you're going to talk about that is going to drag everybody in? Or Nick used to make fun of it, that they would say, what is your arc going to be for this week? Like, God, I can't even remember the things we did. Like, one of them was, and it was true, Declan can't cook. And so you build this arc and you plan it out and you go, like, this is when Nick and I were on Triple M for a brief period. Declan can't cook. On the second day, we'll do an interview with his girlfriend who says he's a terrible cook. On the third day, we'll get Manu Fidel on the line and he'll give Declan a recipe. On the fourth day, Declan will cook that recipe. And on the fifth day, we'll hear, you know, what his girlfriend's got to say about that. All of that actually happened across 5 days on our show. It did end quite amusingly in that my girlfriend got sick off the food that I cooked for her at the time. But I remember her saying to me, this is the last time I'm involved in one of your stupid things. But it's funny because the difference in a podcast is you don't plan it. It's something that comes up organically, and it's somebody has messaged you or somebody has. And I remember the big boy thing was organic. Nick was talking about kind of being at a pub watching the footy, and the people that kind of frightened him most was those Aussie guys that would wear big shorts and would often have like a polo shirt or a Hard Rock Cafe Bali t-shirt on. And he said you knew them because you would always hear this change clinking in their pockets when they walked. And he goes, the only word I can think about for these guys is big boys, like they're boys that never grew up. And it just kind of, and it's funny, you do it and you don't think about it and you post the episode. And then suddenly, you know, 20, 30, 40 listeners start messaging you or writing on Facebook or tweeting like, oh, I know a big boy. And they start like taking photos of their mates and sending it, and it just catches. And it was this insane thing where people were photographing their mates, or they were, then somebody goes, here's a big boy sighting for this week. And it was quite remarkable. Like, people were sending like photos of guys they took on trains and trams. We had to like stop putting those up because it was kind of invading people's privacy, but it just caught like it just, and we never planned it. And yeah, I do worry. I worry with a new listener that you have this inbuilt language. And you kind of, the show has its own, it's kind of like turning up. I did Indonesian at uni, and it's kind of like turning up to the class like halfway through the year, and everybody knows the language and knows each other and you don't. But I've been really conscious of it to say, to try and give explanations every time, like, oh, so, you know, a big boy is X, or to try and invite people into that world. And every now, it's funny with a podcast, I always find like you'll have this peak and then the listeners gradually drop off because everybody can't keep listening to everything. And when I say drop off, like it just drops a little bit. And then you'll do something and there'll be another peak. And I thought we were over all the peaks until early this year or early last year in the pandemic. Nick's job working at the Weekly was to watch quite seriously 3 hours of Studio 10 every day to try and find. They were doing little clips on
and
the show.
And what a gold mine that turned out to be.
Well, it did drive him a bit nuts because he was working from home. He was watching it every day, and then he was having to rewatch it to try and find bits that he could reuse on the show.
Yeah, that's cruel. That's really cruel.
And he was in this particularly, in a bit of a mood. We were recording remotely because of the pandemic. I could just tell he was a bit edgy, and I said to him, like, it's something like, are you annoyed? He goes, I'm sorry, I've been watching an inordinate amount of Studio 10, and my will to live is going. And then he went on this rant about Studio 10 and specifically about Joe Hildebrand. And it wasn't your usual, like, oh, I can't stand Joe Hildebrand. It was such a specifically odd thing that Nick was so annoyed that Joe Hildebrand had said, look, everybody knows the internet just shuts off at 6 p.m. every night. There's no point being on the internet. So our family has decided to go analog and we've bought a DVD player. And something about that enraged Nick to the point. There's a lot in it, like in that grab, like he says.
Oh, I remember.
I've had to watch an inordinate amount of Studio 10 whilst in isolation, and Joe Hildebrand on that show, he is grotesque in a way that I can't put into words. He had this thing today where he said, what happens is everyone knows this, like because of the crisis and the lockdown, at about 6 o'clock at night, the internet just goes in, it goes out to lunch or something, like everything's just really slow to upload. So what we've done is I've bought a DVD player online, and yeah, we're going analog. We're watching DVDs. And I was just looking at him going, what the fuck are you talking about? At 6 o'clock every night, nothing happens to my internet. Nothing. There's not a gust of air happens to it. But he's going, oh no, everybody knows. Everyone in the whole fucking world knows the internet dies at 6 o'clock at night. And it's like, no, it doesn't, you lying. And who's he for? The people watching Studio 10, I assume, are like older women who are buying fucking shithouse pieces of exercise equipment that do jack shit, or bowls to store old pies in. Why would they want to watch Joe Hildebrand?
But it's like the internet, you know, firstly, the internet doesn't shut down at 6 p.m. It's never shut down at 6 p.m. And secondly, he says, we've gone analog. We've bought a DVD player. And DVD player is called a digital video disc. Like, and something about that sent Nick insane. And as I was re-listening to it, I just couldn't stop laughing. And I didn't even think. I just thought, I'll just put this up and as a bit of a teaser to the episode. And it was during the pandemic, and I was homeschooled. I put up in the morning, homeschooled my kids for the rest of the day, and just happened to check my phone at 3. And it was like, you have 3,000 retweets, 400 comments. It was insane. And the thing had been viewed in the space of a day like 30,000 times. And it becomes, we never had something go viral like that. And then it becomes its own, it gets its own momentum. Suddenly people had screen grabbed it and then reposted it. Before I knew it, It was on top of Reddit. It had like, and it was just about this very specific thing that no, the internet doesn't shut off at six. And it, I think it must have annoyed Joe Hildebrand, because for months after that, people would tweet at Joe Hildebrand, like, what are you doing being on Twitter at 6 p.m.? You know the internet shuts off.
And it just, it was, I missed all of that. I missed all of that because Joe decided to block me a couple of years ago.
Oh, right, yeah.
I watched one random episode of Studio 10, tweeted my comments, and was immediately blocked.
Yeah.
Whereas you guys turned it into a career.
But that's what I can't work out. Why didn't he block us? Like, his phone must have caught fire that day. Like, he didn't block me. He didn't block the sweetest plum. And it, we end up doing a whole episode. The next episode was about the reactions to it. And we got, like, fun, you know, messages from Joe Hildebrand's neighbors and people that have worked on the show. And, it was, yeah, it, he never blocked us, and it kind of just, like, the whole next episode was called Relaunching the Hildebrand, and it was reactions that we'd got, and that went from, we went from, like, I don't know, at the time maybe we were getting for an episode like 5,000 an episode or something, and it literally spiked that the next episode we got 15,000. I mean, from a minute thing that Nick just said that at the time I thought was amusing, but it's that thing, you, if you plan to go viral or you plan for something to catch, it never works.
Yeah.
But it's when you do something kind of, that's a, this show, that's why we never plan for the sweetest plum. Every time we do something, going right back to the start, just going, let's make the show, it's always the accidents that work. And so I try not to intellectualize it too much. I just, you know, it's, if for some reason it's the accidents that kind of work for us.
Yeah, right. You know, you're almost like a an elder statesman of podcasting in this country at this point. But I noticed in 2020 a hell of a lot of comedians.
Oh, I'm going to put that. I'm going to make people say that, like, on my intros for things now.
Yeah, take
an
it,
elder
take
statesman
it to the bank.
Of podcasting. I'm going to use elder statesman, pioneer, trailblazing.
Yep.
I'm going to use elder. I'll take elder statesman. I'm more than happy with that title.
But yeah, in 2020, a hell of a lot of comedians suddenly realized that they better have a podcast because every live venue shut down.
Yeah.
Are you getting a lot of comedians asking for advice on kind of how you were able to successfully build a show, or do you feel that a lot of your success is because of the fact that you were there so early?
Yeah, I do think it's that. I do think it's because we were there so early, but I also think it's because we kept doing it. Like, if you go to iTunes, you will see, like, I mean, I'm sure you've been on iTunes, you to the app now Apple Podcasts menu, it's called, you'll see, like, there's so many shows that somebody did for kind of 6 or 10 or 15 episodes. Mm-hmm. And that's when it's easy, when you kind of got this energy and you've bought the gear and you're really excited. Mm,
the honeymoon period and, yeah.
Yeah, and you kind of, like, you know, your mates like it at the start. And then, like anything, like learning a new instrument or a skill, there's this hard bit where you hit it, where you realize we have to keep doing this and do it all the time and keep engaging with listeners. And because we've had periods that, the dumbest thing we ever did was about 5 years ago. We were both really busy. I was working on Ronnie Cheng, international student. Nick was working on The Weekly and on something else at the time. And we didn't post an episode for about 4 months. And that's when people get annoyed. It's because it's like you've been this friend that's always been there for them. And, like, we kept apologizing online, but we should have just, that was before we knew how to do it remotely. We should have just done it remotely, or just done it, you know, called each other up and recorded it or something. And that we had a huge dip then, because people have, and I think they thought, oh, they've just disappeared. And like, you know, we get messages from people going, have you died, or is one of you sick? Or, and that was really silly. Like, we should have, I think we've got most of those people back, but we shouldn't have done, we should have stuck at it. But when you stick at it, it gives this consistency to people. Mm. And I think that, yeah, I think that's a lot to do with it, is that we've kept doing it. Like, the only two that are still going from that time in comedy podcasts is us and Will Anderson's Tofop podcast. And we started a week apart from each other, and we've both been going for 10 years. Mm. And I think that's a lot to do with it. The phone call, I wouldn't say people get advice before they do their show, because most people with podcasts just plug their gear in and go, and it's a lot easier. I was we get a lot of our equipment from Manny's Music and DJ Store. Like, they've got really good, it's kind of really accessible gear, but I was there buying a microphone during the pandemic, and they've got things that are now called, like when we started, if you said we want to do a podcast, they had no idea. They'd just give you a bunch of gear. Now I saw on their shelf, they've got all these like kits that are called content creator kits. And it's like they give you everything. And so the phone call that I usually get is the first time someone has deleted their own episode. I usually get this, oh my God, how do I get it back? Mm. And you can hear the panic and you just go, you can't, you can't, I'm sorry, that is gone. It like will never come back.
Groundskeeper Willie's Game Boy, yeah.
Yeah, it once it's gone, it never comes back. And you kind of realize like you... It's actually part of the rite of passage of being a podcaster is not only do you have to delete your own episode, it usually has to have been the best one you've ever done.
Oh, totally. Yeah, yeah.
Like there has to be this moment where you are screaming and swearing at your own podcast when you're I remember years ago a listener actually realized it was me in a cafe and tweeted, just spotted Declan F. at a cafe, and he is holding up both middle fingers and swearing at his computer screen. And it was true. It was I hadn't lost the whole podcast, but I'd lost a section of it. Mm-hmm. And this listener realized it was me. I don't know. They heard me swearing and recognized my voice. Or that was it. That's the call I got a lot during the pandemic. How do you do it remotely? And B, what do I do if I've lost an episode? And I said, you yell and swear a lot, and then you go back and record another one really quickly before you start to brood on it. But yeah, I would say once people have started, it's those questions of how do I keep listeners? How do I, especially now, how do I find listeners? Because there is only a finite amount of podcast listeners, and the pie, every time a new podcast comes, the pie keeps getting sliced, like, thinner and thinner. And so there's a lot of that. There's a lot of that these days, I think, that people wondering, not so much, I think them starting it is okay, but what do you do to keep going with it and to build it?
Yeah, right. Now that we are past the worst of 2020 and, you know, we were joking before we started recording that, there's going to be a long hangover of 2020 right into 2021.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you hope to bring back some live shows and a bit more of that audience engagement?
Yeah, we love doing the live shows. The initial live show is because I had heard I used to listen to, well, I still do listen to This American Life. And when they did their live shows, and they always made them really big events, like people would come and write a new thing for that show. Well, there was one woman, like, again, just a story that Tig Notaro had told before she was the kind of like very famous comedian she's now, had told a story on This American Life about how she was, as a kid, obsessed with Taylor Dane, the pop star from the 1980s, and how she had run into Taylor Dane three times in her life and embarrassed herself in front of her every time. And so she told that, they got her to redo that story at the live show, and then they kind of in secret, they had booked Taylor Dane, and Taylor Dane came out and performed. And I remember listening to it going, that's amazing. They've taken just a quick throwaway story Tig Notaro told, and they've built it into a kind of event, like they've kind of brought it to life in front of your eyes. And I remember thinking that I'd love to do something like that. So we started doing live podcasts. We did them at Trades Hall, and we'd plug the computer into the desk, and the sound guy would be hanging microphones to try and catch the audience's laugh. And I'd always say, can you pump the like audio up on the audience laugh, so it sounds like they're having this, you know, insane time. And that's kind of what we did. Like we tried to do one or two every year to try and make it a live event. And then ironically, we did a show last year because we always had this thing about could we make it to 180 episodes, because Nick always loved when he was watching the darts growing up, that the darts commentator, the highest score you could get was 180, and the darts commentator would go, 180. And so we decided we'd do a show. And ironically, the show last year for our 180th, well, it was a live show, and it was on March 13th. Which was just before, it was the day that, everybody panicked about coronavirus. The Grand Prix was cancelled that morning. Mm-hmm. The comedy festival was cancelled that afternoon. And then all those lockdown measures started to come in. So we did that gig And I remember because everyone was quite nervous, like we had a few people, like quite a few people not turn up. And I remember Nick walked out and he said to the audience, because we had all this stuff planned, but it's like, what's going on with this virus? I remember Nick just goes, before I could say anything, goes, okay, now who is frightened? And like the whole audience applauded. And we did the rest of the show. And then yeah, we didn't see each other for the next year. Everything after that was remote recording. But for us, it became a kind of therapy. Like we both had jobs that we had to do remotely and we both had kids that had to be homeschooled. And the recording became like the one thing every week or every couple of weeks that if for us, we were no longer taking it for granted. It wasn't me going, oh, I've got to drive to Nick's house again. It was like, oh, I've got a chance to kind of talk about how I feel. Like it actually... it became very, very, very therapeutic for us during last year. But I would love to, we're very close to 200 episodes and we've got like five to go. And I would love if we could do a live 200th show. Because obviously when we started and didn't know what we were doing and didn't even know how to talk into the mics, we would never have thought, oh, we're going to do 200 more of these. Mm-hmm. So I'd love to do a live gig for the 200th. So hopefully, you know, hopefully the restrictions can stay eased in Victoria.
Do you ever go back to that March 13 episode and listen to it? Because it feels like that would be such an amazing, you know, moment in time. You know, I remember that time so well as well.
Yeah.
I was actually in a Formula One car going around the racetrack.
Oh my God.
As part of this like PR bullshit thing. And the whole time, yeah. I mean, you know, driving 300 Ks an hour is pretty weird. And then pulling up and thinking, this whole thing is cancelled. It's even weirder.
Well, I imagine the one unbelievably safe place to not catch COVID would be in a Formula One car. It's you've got a helmet on.
I don't know. You're pretty close to the driver. They don't let you do it by yourself.
Oh, that's true, actually. Yeah, that's true. But yeah, I did when I was putting together our greatest hits album, which we just put out. I went back and listened to the live show and I used audio from different live shows in the greatest hits, but I didn't use that night because I kind of, it's such an odd standalone night in terms of where it stands for us and where it stood in the timeline of COVID. And it's weird. It's got a slightly different energy to it. It's celebratory, but you can also feel this kind of trepidation. And interestingly, Nick is a bit germophobic and he actually came out at the start in a mask and gloves and people thought he was joking, but he was kind of truth for him that he was scared, like what's going to happen. And then you can hear this noise through the podcast it sounds like that, like you can hear this like rubbing. And I was like, what is that noise? And then I remembered that it was Nick. He actually bought hand sanitizer on stage and was hand sanitizing himself like routinely throughout the show. And I remember thinking at the time, like, oh, that seems a bit excessive. And thinking, and I was kind of laughing. Like, I think there's a bit where I say to him, did you just sanitize your hands? And like, it's kind of leaning into the silliness of it. But if you fast forward, I've said this to him a few times. I said, he was actually ahead of the curve on the coronavirus restrictions. He was doing it before it was cool. He was doing it before you had to do it when you walked into every shop and when you pick up your kids from school. He was doing it a long time before. He was championing the mask before anyone was doing the mask. And so it's an odd moment in time. I kind of like that it's on that night. Like we joked on the night. We said this could be the last comedy gig this could be the last comedy gig anybody watches for a long time. And it was a joke. Like I didn't. And then it then happened. Like, you know, the comedy festival was cancelled and there wasn't another comedy gig in Melbourne for at least 6 months, maybe even 9 months. Like it was, yeah, it was a very, very, it's an odd moment in time. I kind of like that it's such a distinct moment in time, but it's, yeah, I wouldn't want to do it again. And knowing what we know now, like we would have cancelled the gig. We just didn't, you know, we didn't know that that's what, you know, that's what was going to happen. So I do remember talking to a guy that night, one of the listeners, and I said, what do you reckon is going to happen And he said, ah, look, it's, and I remember him so flippantly, he wasn't being a bad guy, just because we didn't have the information yet. He goes, oh, I work in the hospitality industry. We don't shut down for anything. We'll just keep going. It'll be okay. And then, you know, fast forward a month and everything was shut down. Mm. A few times I did wonder, what happened to that guy? Like, what's he doing now? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The other memory that really sticks out for me is the Sunday before then, before everything went to hell, I took my daughter to the MCG and we watched the cricket grand final.
Oh, yeah, that was whatever. The Women's World Cup,
yeah,
wasn't
the Women's
it?
World yeah. Cup with 110,000 other people.
Yeah.
And again, it was just – it was such a weird thing of, like, looking around the stadium going – is this all, should I be here?
Yeah. It's yeah. so.
And a week later,
do you find that
done?
Do you find that thing where you watch, I've been watching the SBS show, We Are Who We Are. And in the last episode, they go to a big concert in Italy and they're all like jammed in and you know, and kind of watching this concert. And I found myself getting really anxious watching it. Like I said to my partner, oh, there's no social distancing. And it's kind of weird how, like, it's going to be interesting how all that, you know, how all that goes. I think it's going to be a very tentative step back for everybody. It's funny. A friend of mine went to the Cash Savage playing at the Forum, and she said, everyone was very respectful with the distancing, but she said you could feel this kind of joy in the room, like, oh, my God, we can do this again. So, yes, in that is a very long answer to your question. I hope that we can do a 200th gig somewhere, and I imagine Nick will bring enough sanitizer for everybody.
Fantastic. Well, if he does, I'll be there.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is an ABC podcast.
A brother and a sister are playing in a band together called Crossbreak. When we say cross, you say break. Cross,
cross. When we say cross, you say my name is Ken Lim. This is my six-part podcast about the Christian hip-hop band that changed my life.
Get it up for Crossbreak!
This is a nightmare.
Imagine how stoked God would be. He'd just be sitting up there in heaven and he'd just be munted. He'd be pinging on the Holy Spirit.
They shone brighter than the Star of David, but were destroyed faster than Sodom and Gomorrah.
And that's when I began to drink the sacramental wine.
What sort of a Christian are you?
What's with all the Jesus shit, mate?
Okay, I'm pulling over. Does anyone else need to vomit?
What the hell is going on?
And why am I making this podcast? Because Crossbred were really cool.
No one cares about your podcast, Ken.
The idea for this this chat, I thought, you know, a quick 15 on the sweetest plum.
Yeah, sorry.
Then we'll move on. No, I've enjoyed every moment. But, 44 minutes in, we should probably talk about what was, I think, my favourite podcast of last year.
Oh, thanks very much.
No, honestly, like I've gone back through the lists and stuff, and you know, I was asked to write a listicle, and I don't really like doing that. So I threw you in with the mix. But Crossbred was remarkable. It was a really, really fun little series that you co-wrote and put together. Talk me through Crossbred and how it actually started at the ABC.
Okay, so it was like, so Crossbred was a podcast about the rise of a fake Christian hip hop group in Boronia, in Victoria. So the ABC about maybe, God, I'd say end of 2017 were doing a thing where they were asking for scripted podcast pitches. It was a day before they were due in and I hadn't done one yet. And I happened to be in Sydney and I was meeting an old friend of mine that I went to school with, and his name is Chris Ryan. and he is now one of Australia's like best like singers in musicals. Like he was the lead in the David Bowie musical, and he's been in, you know, he was the lead in the King Kong musical, and we went to high school together. And I said to him, I want to do a scripted podcast, and I feel like music, it'd be the perfect thing for a musical. And this is like, I had a day to kind of come up with something. And I just said to him, because he had grown up as an opera singer, and I always liked those kind of weird insular worlds. And I said, would there be something about a brother and a sister who blow up as a kind of opera singing duo? And then he said to me, I really like your idea about doing a podcast as a musical, but if I can stop you there, I've been an opera singer for 20 years and nobody gives a shit about opera singers. And then he said, in fact, it's the one way to clear people at a party mm-hmm. is to start talking about opera. And he said, but is there something else we could do? And we started talking because we'd gone to school together. We were kind of – and we had also been in a Christian youth group together. And when you go to those Christian youth camps, there's always a band, and the band is the big way to get like people involved in the Christian youth group. And then he said, could we do something about that? Like it's a Christian youth group band that blows up. Somehow they cross over, they go viral, and they blow up. And we were trying to work it out because when we were at school, they were always kind of like a bit grungy. Like they're always trying to sound like Pearl Jam or and we were trying to work out what would be the music now. And Chris just said to me, he said, and he's not a huge hip hop fan, but he said, he knew like I was kind of like, I'm the kid that grew up wanting to be a rapper. And like, I'm like the whitest hip hop fan there ever is. And he goes, wouldn't it be hip hop? Wouldn't that be the way now that you would get a group of people? And he just kind of said it off the top of his head. And I said, that might be it. And I literally, we had the night to write it. And I was staying with him in his apartment, and he had to write a page and send it off to the ABC. And we just wrote this Christian hip hop band gets picked up by one of the big Pentecostal churches. They blow up and they become the biggest thing, except they're not really Christians. And that was kind of it. And maybe a few months later, we got a phone call from the ABC and found out that they had chosen ours to be this scripted comedy podcast. And I remember saying to Chris, like, we're going to have to find someone who is, it needs to be good. Like it can't be twee hip hop. Like for it to break, there's got to be something great about it. I said, we need a really good musician, like a great musician who's also funny. And Chris had done a Fringe show with Megan Washington and just said, maybe it's Megan Washington. And he said, she is one of the most talented people I've ever met. And she's really funny. And, he introduced me to her, and it turns out Megan was in a Christian youth group. Because she could sing, they would send her out to be one of their big recruiters.
Mm-hmm.
And like 5 minutes into the conversation, I was just like, it has to be Megan. She's got to be in this thing. Like, and we all started working on it. We wrote it pretty quickly. We wrote it probably we talked about it a lot, but the actual writing, we did it in about 3 months, and we just sat there and we tried to write. We weren't ever trying to make fun of Christians because we had all grown up in Christian youth groups. But at the same time, like, we loved things like Spinal Tap. And it's like, you want to capture the truth of it and then kind of like exaggerate it. And so we just told true stories about what happened to us in Christian youth groups. Like you'd go to these big tents in the middle of the bush somewhere, and there'd be this huge like Christian thing with all these kids, and we kept writing about all of that, and we just got this idea that it would be the rise and fall and then the rise again of a Christian hip-hop group. And it was one of those things that you don't always know that you're onto a winner. But the first time me, Chris, and Megan sat in a room and we started talking about our experiences and just plotting them on the wall, I just had this feeling, it's going to work. I thought maybe we've got God on our side. and then the first song that Megan wrote, I said, we need a song that hooks everybody, that catches everybody that listens to this, everyone in the show that listens to this fake band has to be turned into a Christian. And she wrote this amazing song called Just Jesus, about what if Jesus appeared in the food court of a suburban shopping center. And as soon as she wrote it and she texted, she like sent it to me as a voice message. And I just, it was just the most extraordinary thing. And, you know, you put it out and it was in the middle of the pandemic. And I was like, is anyone going to care about this? Like, it's such an absurd thing about the rise of this Christian Pentecostal hip hop group. And I think because it was so different to the reality of what was going on, it was a complete alternate reality. It was quite absurd. The characters were quite lovable. And it, you know, within a couple of weeks, it was suddenly being named in Apple Podcast Best Shows. It was named Apple US, it was named in the Best Shows. And I think also there wasn't much being made. Like, there hadn't been a comedy festival. There hadn't been, there wasn't going to be a fringe festival. There wasn't much for people to kind of consume and listen to fiction-wise. Like, a lot of the ABC comedy shows were held up, and it suddenly this thing appears and it was its own whole world, so far removed from a pandemic. Like, there's thousands of people at the gigs, you know, in the podcast. And I think it was such an alternate reality that people could escape to it. For it landed right in the middle of that kind of Melbourne second wave. Right at the start of it. It was like, I think we started in July, and it was kind of an escape or an alternate reality for people.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing you said that really stuck out was the fact that you didn't make fun of this group of people, that it would be so easy to take the easy gags, to play on the easy gags of these people. But instead, and I think, you know, obviously you were incredibly lucky, and God was smiling on you when it turns out you were all part of a youth group and you had that experience. You had that. When I listen to it, there's a real sense of place that comes through, like the food courts, like the weird suburban churches that you find.
Yeah.
I never grew up in Melbourne suburbs, but I felt those suburbs as I was listening to it. I could picture exactly what those food courts looked like.
And
so all of that was lovely. And I listened to it all in, you know, part of my job is to listen to lots of podcasts and find the good ones and elevate them. And so I had heard about this, and so I stuck it on and thought that I'd listen to one or two episodes and then maybe get in touch with you. And I was picking up something for my kid. This was when you couldn't leave more than 5Ks from your house during Melbourne lockdown. And my friend actually lived 40Ks away. So I felt like I was doing some kind of like Cold War, you know, like I was crossing the city border.
I did a couple of those.
You know, and in my head I was like, I'm not doing anything wrong because I'm just like, I'm pulling up to his house. He's going to put the thing in the boot and then I'm going to drive away and there's going to be no contact at all. But I was still terrified as I was driving down the freeway of like, I'm 6Ks from my house. What's going to happen?
Yeah.
During that whole time, I put on episode one, and by the time I came back from, you know, my terrifying run, had listened to the entire series and I was just in love with it.
Yeah. Look, I think when you initially write something, you cycle through the kind of easy jokes for something. And we kind of realized it would be really easy to make fun of Christianity, especially, you know, with some of the things that have happened in Catholic schools. And we kind of realized that. And then we kind of also realized that we had two things. We could easily make fun of Christianity and we could easily make fun of Aussie hip hop. And there's great Australian hip hop, but there's also kind of the, you know, the cliched version of like drinking some beers and talking to mates kind of thing. And we kind of realized like, it's not going to work. It's going to run out. Like if you do a gag and it's not based in a truth, and we all realize that if we all three of us, in our own different ways, and Megan lived in Brisbane, we lived in Melbourne, had all been attracted to Christian youth groups, and we all knew people that were. There's got to be something that's attracting people, kids to it. Like, there's got to be some truth in it. And likewise, we kind of thought, like, there's a truth in that suburbia. And so you want to anchor it to that truth. Like, there was heaps of gags we didn't, or heaps of kind of characters we didn't do that would have just been too easy and they would just throw away. And I kind of felt like if you can catch that truth, because when you're a kid, like you try on lots of different masks. Like I loved hip hop growing up, but then I also loved going to these Christian youth groups, but then I would go and listen to these songs that were like set in like South Central LA. And so you've got like, you've got all these worlds, and you, when you're a kid, you like, you earnestly believe something, like whatever it is, whether it's your religion, whether it's a music, whether it's, I don't know, whether it's a book that you like you believe it more than anything. Like, you kind of, there's a purity to that belief. And we thought, we have to catch what attracted us to it, and that, and find the truth in that, and find the truth in the kind of human relations. And so that was kind of it. Like, we just always reminded ourselves, don't take the piss, like, don't take the easy way on this. Like, you'll find something funny, but don't do the kind of easy gags on it. And it, I don't know, it was in some ways, it was a way for us to, Chris and I had been in this Christian youth group, but never really talked about it. Like, you know, for 10, 15, 20 years, or this odd chapter of our life. Mm. And it was a way to recapture that, you know, suburban upbringing. Like, we, you know, the food courts, that was where, you know, before there was trendy cafes or there was places that kids could go and hang out, you would meet in the Doncaster shopping town food court. You know, that was where you went. And so for us, it was kind of, we were trying to catch a truth of that time. My only concern was, like, I remember saying to Chris, I'm a bit worried, because if you go to like Doncaster shopping town food court now, like, it's really, really upmarket.
Yep.
Like,
yep.
It's kind of like, it looks like you're walking into a restaurant or like, and like a really like a luxury kind of place. And I said, do those, you know, do they still exist? And it obviously caught some truth in people, because it, I think it had a touch of nostalgia to it. Mm. Of like, and that it was a time that wasn't the pandemic, and it was kind of, it had a touch of innocence to it, and when we didn't know nearly as much as we know now. So maybe that's what resonated.
Yeah. Yeah. And mate, those food courts still exist. You live just around the corner from Northland.
I have a very, very, very deep affection to Northland. I like that you have to walk through the main entrance walks you through the food court. Mm-hmm. So there's no such thing as a calm meal there. Wherever you sit, there's just hordes of people walking past you. Yeah, I kind of, it's interesting, you have kids and you have to go and shop at those places. I've kind of regrown an affection for those places now. I kind of, you can get yourselves lost. They're kind of like, you walk in and you walk into a different world. So yeah, that was the thing. And I still remember when Megan sent me that song and she had written it, and it's the one that blows the group up. And she had got her producer, who's a guy called Mario Spate, who's done lots of like pop music records. And she said to him, you need to make this the biggest hip hop pop music, like, kind of emphatic song. And I didn't know him at all. And I remember she sent it, and it was 2 days before we had to finish the podcast. And I went for a walk just going, please let this sound good. And I started listening to it, and it's this epic kind of song about Jesus visiting a food court. And I initially started, when you could only just walk around the corner from your house during the pandemic, I was wearing a mask, and I initially started laughing because it just sounded so ridiculous. These lyrics that we'd written was so, and with this epic background. And then once it hit and the crowd starts talking in tongues and there's record scratching, I just burst into tears. And I never react to my own work. I don't laugh at it. I don't. And I just like, and I think it was a bit the pandemic as well. I was in this side street near my house, and this guy in his front yard sees this guy in a mask with headphones on laughing and crying simultaneously. Mm-hmm. He didn't know what, he was kind of like looking at me like, are you okay? And I just had this moment where I was like, I don't really care how this is received. Like, I know that we've made something that's very truthful to us. Like, and, then, you know, luckily it was received. It was received very well. And I'm very, very proud of it. It
must be remarkable to come up with an idea like that and so far away from someone like Megan Washington, and then seeing what a creative person like that can bring to the idea that you had, and seeing it transform in that way.
I remember the first time she came to my house and we were plotting the show and trying to write songs, and she had her computer with Logic and a keyboard, and she goes, "So what's the song like?" And I would say, I would play her a hip hop song that I liked growing up, and she'd go, "Oh, okay, I get it." And then she'd literally build a beat and then build music on top of it. And you're watching this, like I could write the lyrics, but I can't make the music, and you're watching this come together in front of you. It's this weird thing. You kind of often write what you wish could have happened. Like you kind of write the, you know, you kind of, and I think, you know, this 15-year-old kid, I kind of wanted to be a rapper and make music, but it was never, ever, ever going to happen. It was just this fantasy that you had as a 15-year-old kid. And then suddenly this music's appearing in front of you. And I just found it, I mean, what she taught me was, in my mind, there was like writing and there was music. And she just said kind of flippantly one day, she just goes, "But everything's musical." And she said, "When you tell a story in a song, you still have to have the music at the start and you have to build and there has to be a climax." And when she said everything's musical, it kind of tied those two bits of my life together that I thought were separate. This love of music growing up and this love of writing. It was like, oh my, I just literally hadn't had that thought. Comedy writing so much about dialogue and jokes, and I just went, oh, it is musical. Like you're kind of creating a composition, and so and especially with a podcast, you're trying to create a world for the listener. It was just one of those moments where you just, that only happen every now and then in this industry, but I just had this moment as we were writing it where I just thought, I really like that my life has ended up here.
Yeah. Now you said you have kids, and mm-hmm. What was it like?
And one of them's about to walk into the room, I reckon.
Yeah, yeah.
I've heard a bit like scratching at the door.
Well, I'll let you go in a second. What was their reaction when they walked into their home and found Calypso from Bluey?
they were, once I said this is, cause you know, somebody new is suddenly working in your house, writing these songs. And I said, "Oh guys, this is Calypso from Bluey," and they were in awe. That there's a little like with the 4-year-old, he's trying to work out like, oh, hang on, if she's the voice, then who's the character? Because those characters are still real to him. But I mean, it's to be Calypso from Bluey on what was their favorite show. Like when every new episode came out, they would immediately watch it. It was kind of like the jaws hit the floor, and they don't care what I do or my writing. It's just like, you know, Calypso. It gave me a huge amount of parent cred in my house, I carried that cred for a long, long time.
Well, congratulations on that. Yeah. Finally, because your kids are probably desperate to see you again. What's it like right now, being a comedian working in Australia, watching things like Auntie Donna become so successful on Netflix, and Amazon are dipping their toes into live comedy and as well. How do you feel about the industry at the moment?
I loved that Auntie Donna got that show. I saw their first ever show. I had seen a friend play at the Portland Hotel, and the Portland Hotel is quite zhuzhy now, but at the time it was a former strip club where some of the stages still had the poles on them and people were doing comedy. And I'd watched a friend play that night, and then we were in the bar and we were just like, we should see another show. And Auntie Donna were playing at 11 p.m. at the Portland Hotel. And I went in with a friend, and it was everything that you love about young comedians starting. It was the energy in that room was wild. They were playing on this tiny stage. The stage was built like in this empty room. It was built out of wood. And there was this small door. And I remember they kept bumping into each other, going in and out of the door. But they came into the crowd, and I just remember thinking it had the most phenomenal energy to it, and it had this kind of very infectious energy. They were still young, so they'd found their voice, but they were still working on their craft. And for weeks after that, I said to people, "You've got to see Auntie Donna. You've got to see Auntie Donna." And I really admired that they kept sticking with it, you know, for years after that, and kept kind of experimenting with their comedy and kept working. Because when it starts and you've got that excitement, that's the easy bit, like we were saying about the podcast. But it's when you get 2-3 years in and you know, you might have missed a couple of things, or you just, you haven't had that next big opportunity kick off. That's the hard bit. That's when a lot of people kind of, I was a sketch comedian, and after 3 years of doing it, I kind of went, okay, that's enough now. Like I didn't have another thing to say. And so when I watched Auntie Donna, and similar to Crossbred, I just loved that on that American show, they were mentioning things like Crazy John's mobile phone.
Same. I think that's one of the bits that really just blows my mind every time I see it. It's like, you know, Ringwood, Car City, and like...
The Car City one. I bought my car from Car City. Mm. Like it, and everybody remembers those ads. But I loved, because when you work on a show, especially in Australia, I think we have a kind of an inbuilt, a lot of producers and a lot of like, network people have an inbuilt inferiority complex where they think, oh, you can't make a reference that people won't understand overseas. I don't even know if it's inferiority. They just get scared of alienating the viewer. And the amount of times I've been told, don't put that in, nobody knows what that reference is, or don't do that. And it was interesting because in Crossbred, we decided we're going to say Forest Hill, we're going to say Boronia, we're going to mention the names of streets in Boronia. And it worked. People would text us and say, I grew up in that area. I can't believe that you know.
Well, again, it's what makes Bluey so lovely as well. Bluey feels like it's in Brisbane. It feels like it.
That's why Bluey stands out, because it's not Melbourne. It's not Sydney, where everything gets made. It's Queensland. It uses the colour of Queensland, and it's got the pace of Queensland. It doesn't do that thing that kids shows do where they cut really fast and there's no breath. Like so many animations are like, whoosh, whoosh, like you worry that it's turning your kid into like ADD or something. And Bluey just plays out. Like there's one episode, I'm pretty sure one episode with the grandmother plays out in like two shots at the birthday party.
Mm.
It just plays between two rooms. And the kids are still enthralled by it. You don't need 1,000 cuts to kind of keep their attention. If you write a good story and you have a good sense of place and a truth to it, people will keep watching. And so when I saw that in Auntie Donna, I immediately, I knew Broden quite well, and I texted him and I just said, fucking good on you. I'm going to be for using all those references, for leaning in hard on your Australianness and this, and not explaining it. Why is a bunch of Australians living in a share house in LA? Mm. Like, it's never explained.
Does Car City Ringwood sponsoring the Ellen Show?
No, it's amazing. I mean, they've got references to like footy, like Gary Lyon, they mention at one stage. And I'll be using that as like evidence to producers and people for years who say, don't use that reference, because they leaned into those references. They leaned into who they are. They'd always use those kind of like Rocker Steadford references. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, what it does is like Bluey, or it creates something distinct that no one else can copy. So there's hundreds of sketch shows in the States on streamers, but nobody else is talking about Car City Ringwood. Or nobody else is mentioning Crazy John's mobile phones. And so it suddenly gets its own language and its own sound, and it makes it feel very distinct. And so I was so pleased for them. And I kind of, even just the idea of like they keep every episode, somebody dies who visits their house and they turf them into one of the like green rubbish bins.
Yeah, yeah.
Like that's so Australian suburban. And I could imagine, you know, producers saying like, oh, why have they got those green bins and they're in LA? And it's like, because that's the world of the show and that's who they are. And to me, it makes total sense. And so I feel like it's a very exciting period for Australian comedy, especially for the DIY people. Like there's the Auntie Donna guys who did it for so long, who played live, who made sketches on YouTube. And then they're blowing up on Netflix. There's the Kates, who I came up with the first show I ever did at uni. Kate McCartney was in, and I knew Kate McLennan when she was starting as a stand-up and a sketch comedian. And their stuff is so distinct to them. Like nobody else could make that.
Mm.
I feel like there's just this little moment where possibly it's been kind of amplified by the pandemic, but it's the people who made stuff themselves and for themselves and who didn't compromise on their vision that it started, you know, people like Greg Larson, who, you know, makes his own stuff, and Ann Edmonds, people like that. They're all DIYers. They don't wait for a show or a network to call them. They just make it and they put it up. It's not that they just throw everything out there. They craft it and it has their own distinct voice. And, you know, even Crossbred kind of fell into that. It couldn't be made anywhere else. It is a show about a Christian youth group in Melbourne. And I kind of, that was something I got out of the pandemic that was very exciting. I got very worried for comedians and the industry when the comedy festival got cancelled. And then I realized the people that want to and the people that love making their own stuff will keep finding a way. You know, they'll shoot stuff on mobile phones or they'll record audio sketches. They'll keep writing stuff and they'll keep making stuff and they'll find a way. I found it extremely heartening. And so I'm kind of quite excited about this next wave of Australian comedy.
Excellent. Look, I've taken far too much of your time and mine as well. I'm now way behind on everything else I needed to do, but you've been such a great guest. I just kept wanting to chat.
No, thanks very much. It's a pleasure to talk about it. And someone who's gone so deep on podcasts and local comedy and who knows it, who, you know, you're not a freelancer. You're actually listening to all the stuff and living it. And, it's really, you know, it's a huge pleasure. And I'm not sucking up because you've already written an article on us. what you do by writing about local stuff, and because you wrote one about Greg Larson and the Grub doing there. I mean, that you're writing about what people are making, and not you're writing it before it's gotten to this huge popularity. And you know, that's the stuff that people and the next generation listen to. So I would talk to you for as long as you need it, because I think you're doing a really good service for our industry.
Well, thank you, mate. Thank you. All right. Well, thank you once again for joining me. And I'll listen to everything you make, mate. All right. Thanks so much, Declan.
Thanks, mate. Bye.
Cheers.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much. And when we're allowed to meet in person again, well, I think we can possibly meet now. Yeah. So maybe we should,
maybe we should like eventually meet. World or something. Because I'm Reza. I know you're Preston, yeah? Or
you're Reservoir. Yeah. There's still, we could meet down at I often take my kids to Crocs Play Center. That's down on the industrial estate.
Yeah. Not well.
During the holidays, a lot of like kids in the thing, like basically, you know, climbing on things and endangering themselves in the holidays while manic parents are like typing on laptops inside the Crocs. So that's where, you know, people often ask at the end of an interview, where can people find you during the week? That's where you will find me, at a kids play center, hunched over a laptop, tethering the signal to my mobile phone.
No, I'll give you some advice. Local advice, the play shed in Thomastown, all of the shit that they can climb on is super well padded and super safe. And they have really good high speed Wi-Fi.
Oh my God. I didn't know. I know Go Climb and I know there's the Cheeky Monkeys one that is down in Northland. I've never heard. What did you call it?
The Playshed Cafe. It's in Thomastown in the industrial estates. and there's like a proper good fence that they can't get through to.
Oh, this is a revelation, because Crocs is great, but there is no fence, and the kids get the cars that Crocs have, and they drive them through where all the parents sit. So as you're sending an email, there's somebody's 4-year-old is ramming a car into your ankle. You kind of leave with like serious like lower leg injuries. So that is the play shed. That's a revelation. This interview is worth it just for that.
I tell you what, man, the amount of SMH articles that have been tapped out in the play shed while my kid is bouncing on like very heavily padded safe equipment. Take that one.
Well, I'm looking after my 4-year-old today. I tell you what, it could be the play shed in the afternoon. That might be that might be where we go.
Enjoy. Report back.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.